Okay, this project was one that I was the project manager on, and it was actually sponsored by our CDC Center for Public Health Preparedness. It was done in partnership with the Texas Department of State Health Services Region 2-3, and I will show you on a map where that is. And we had assistance from the National Emergency Rescue and Response Training Center with the development of our exercises and the implementation of the exercises. And again, I have no relationships to disclose in relation to this project. As I mentioned, we worked with Region 2-3, which is up here around Arlington. The yellowish counties, those are considered urban counties. The gray ones are rural counties. And so there are between 33 and 35 designated rural counties in that area. And we were contracted to work with these counties and to develop and exercise pandemic influenza preparedness plans. And there are three phases to this project. I'll quickly go over phase one and phase two and focus primarily on phase three. And I apologize for the difficulty on seeing that. It looks good on the screen. During August of 2006, we conducted five round tables. And since we had 34 counties, the clusters, there were about six counties in each one, between six and seven. And I mentioned the round tables in the previous presentation that we used that to engage the target audience in rural communities, identify rural public health system stakeholders, local strengths and weaknesses, assets, and to engage local decision makers. And what this does, it's less formal. We facilitate it. It's more of a discussion. And so it creates an environment for stakeholders to address specific rural health issues. And in this case, it was pandemic influenza planning. And the goal of the roundtables were, again, to bring together multidisciplinary stakeholders. You'll hear me say that a lot, multidisciplinary stakeholders, because it's very important that we have representation from everyone in the community, especially in rural areas. And it was also to have a face-to-face discussion just to talk about pan flu issues. At this point in time in the project, not many people were very aware of issues. And then some of the themes that came out for these were the impact of pandemic influenza on their communities, continuity of services, and sharing best practices. A lot of these counties did have experience in sheltering evacuees from Katrina and from Rita, and we were able to build upon that for them to continue planning. And part of phase one was to develop a template for these counties to use. Each county in Texas is mandated to have a pan flu plan. And what we did is we created a template based on the state plan and the regional health plan, so they all feed together. And these templates were provided to each county judge or the emergency management coordinator. And they were supposed to read the plan, fill out the plan, sign it, and have it ready for the exercises. However, we found that only eight of the 34 counties did that. And so the exercises did give those eight counties an opportunity to exercise their plans. For the remaining counties that did not have a plan, we were able to bring the template that we did create, and they were able to at least run through that and decide what they needed to fill in. As you can see, we had low participation on these. Only 20 out of the 34 counties did participate. And phase two began in September of 2006, and we had slightly different counties to work with. We dropped a couple and added one, but I'm not going to get into which counties we did since I don't know how many of you are from Texas, so it's not normal. So phase two also consisted of after-action reports, technical assistant team visits, and sub-regional conferences. The sub-regional conferences, those were put together to have an education component because based on our phase one visits, it was clear that a lot of the judges, emergency management coordinators, and decision makers did not have a clear understanding of pandemic influenza. And so the topics included an update on pan flu in the world today, surge impact on the healthcare system, community containment, isolation and quarantine, and then we culminated it with a tabletop exercise. And we had technical assistance team visits conducted in each county, and that was to generate interest for upcoming activities. And they were done in January and February of 2008. So this was more recent in this year. And the exercises were conducted in a local level. And we'll talk about the importance of that. Again, we did the TAT visits. and we talked about where they were with their pamphlet planning efforts, the issues and barriers they were coming across, and what assistance the county needed at that time to move on in planning. It's really important for rural communities that you gain their trust, that you go to them and you sit down and spend time with them. And we've worked really hard over the past 2.5 years to do that, and it's amazing how far we have come. And again, we had the roundtables, and basically it's the same goals that I talked about earlier, and with the roundtables, they're pretty common. But what we did this time is we grouped the counties together differently. We grouped the counties that would be responding together or that had traditionally or historically responded together and that would be looking to each other for help and assistance. And this worked a lot better. And we also had more roundtables and more locations to increase participation. And it worked. We increased attendance. It was able to provide individual county attention and to better address local issues. And again, we initiated a collaboration planning process, and this was also to strengthen existing partnerships and maybe develop new ones if they hadn't already, and to discuss resources they could share in the event of a response. And several common themes emerged from these roundtables, and I have, I think, 3 or 4 slides with them, but I'll just basically say that we talked about strengths and assets, relationships and partners, concerns and gaps, learning skills and training needs, and other organizations that weren't there that may need to be there in the future to help plan. And then we have various issues and areas of concerns. Animal management, law enforcement, supplies and equipment were examples of those. And this time we had a functional exercise, and it was conducted in each individual county. And this was different than the previous exercises. The first ones were done in different locations. The third were done in 3 urban locations. We had very low participation because we found that people from rural areas were not comfortable going into areas like Dallas, which is a huge metropolitan area, and Abilene and Wichita Falls. So we changed it to actually exercise in the county. And the component that exercised, it was all based on communication, but we looked at public health response plans, the SNS program, their 24/7 capacity for public health response, the FIN notification system, and their crisis and risk communication plan. And we provided observer controllers at each site. We had a control center at the School of Rural Public Health that we either faxed, emailed, or made phone calls to supply the scenarios and injects. And we also were able to utilize FIN to make sure it was working properly. The observer controller stayed and assisted the counties, and they also stayed and helped them create corrective action plans. And each action plan covered the following topics: training needs, coordination and planning needs, resources and PPE needs, and communication needs. And right now, we are actually currently in the process of following up with the county judges or the emergency management coordinators to see where they are in the implementation of these plans. And if time permits, which it probably won't, I'll try and share with you how we're continuing to foster our relationship with these counties in the absence of pamphlet funding. And I won't read through these, but these are just a summary, again, of common themes that we found in each rural community, and they seem to be across the board pretty common no matter where the location is. And quickly I'll go over some evaluation points, and basically the most important thing that we took away from evaluating the entire project is that the number of stakeholders that participate in the activities, it's going to increase the closer their proximity to their county. As you can see, phase one, it was moderate. Phase two went down substantially. That's the phase I discussed where we actually conducted it in urban areas. And then phase three is where we conducted it in their actual county. So as you can see, if it's in their county, they're more likely to attend. And we can look at the type of stakeholders that attended these. We were particularly interested in the green section, which is the non-traditional stakeholders. We were really happy to see that 20% of our participants were what we would consider non-traditional stakeholders. And again, this just implies that we're going to have a greater diversity of participants in phase three, and also that when it occurs in that target county, we're going to have more participants representing different sectors. And again, this just shows participating counties by phase. The green indicates that they participated in all three activities in each phase. And as again, you'll see in phase three, we had increased participation. And this is similar also. We show in phase three that each county did participate in a technical assistance team visit, and 76% participated in the roundtable and the functional exercise, a substantial increase from phases one and two. And this is just a chart that exemplifies. We asked them, you know, was this helpful to you, basically? And it, almost all of them rated either very helpful or extremely helpful. And that should wrap it up.
Thanks. Well, we have some time for questions, and I'm actually going to start the questions off. I had the first question for Aaron, which was, did you find that there was a discordance between thinking about the surge capacity between what the public health officials thought the surge capacity of the private medical sector was and what the medical sector thought their surge capacity was, such that did public health tend to overestimate what the medical sector's capacity was to handle events?
No. No, I think by the time we did this study, so again, the interviews we did were 2007-2008, by that time, public health and the medical community and the hospital community have been working together on this for a number of years, so I don't think there was at that point any misunderstanding in terms of capacity to surge. I think the hospitals had much greater operational concerns about the whole notion of surge, just because that's what they were grappling with.
Okay. Any questions?
It would seem to me that in the rural communities, because of the existence of, say, outreach vans and so forth, that their ability to mobilize in different venues would be enhanced by their ruralness, and they could support the urban areas, whereas because in urban areas, those are mostly fixed facilities, that the government seem to go the other way around. Is that, except
what we have found, we've seen, what state are you from? Are you
California?
Okay, so you're from a huge state as well. With Texas being so large, a lot of the rural communities are very dispersed and out in the middle of nowhere, literally. And so we found that the hurricane, I hate to keep speaking about the hurricanes because I know it's been 3 years, but we had a lot of valuable experiences from that, and we did find that they were able to come together and mobilize to help. They had a lot of evacuees coming through. There were a lot of special needs populations, a lot of healthcare needs. There were need for shelters. So because of the close-knit communities being in the rural areas and people seem to know each other, they were able to draw upon resources. And one of the positive things about the roundtables is that a lot of times they don't recognize that they have resources. A lot of times what they see as their weaknesses are actually strengths, and so it's nice to help point that out to them for a more successful response.
Can you give an example of what the perceived weakness that actually was a strength
would be? They think that since they have a small community, that is a weakness. But it can be seen as a strength because everybody knows each other. And you can pick up the phone and you can call and make sure everyone's okay. It's easier to identify special needs populations. Everybody knows where everyone is. Whereas I live in what I call a bedroom community. I also consider it rural, but I live in an area that's between Houston and College Station. So most people in my area are either in Houston or College Station working. We don't know each other. I know one neighbor. And so in my case, I would be pretty useless in an emergency response. But in these rural areas, everyone does know each other, and they know what resources they have. If they, we need this, we can call him. Whereas in the urban areas and areas where I live, people don't seem to know that.
Can I? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's a really interesting question. And in the study we did, mostly it was focused on urban areas, but I wonder whether one of the problems or challenges in many urban areas is competition for resources. I don't mean the healthcare market competition is one thing, which is less intense in many rural communities, so they may not have that problem. But I'm thinking of where do you put excess patients that you can't fit in a hospital? And what we found in some cities is we've got a grade school across the street from the hospital, but the public health department has laid claim to that to house people who lost their homes or whatever, not patients. So I'm imagining in rural communities maybe that kind of competition for available resources doesn't exist, but that's worth somebody's master's thesis.
Because they are limited.
Thank you for your great presentation. Two questions for two different speakers. One is on the rural health center side. Were you as part of your survey, were you looking also at community health centers not in rural areas? And then on the public hospital side, has anybody done a comparison on public hospital and disaster preparedness coordinators versus private hospital or other kind of model hospital coordinators?
For the health centers, we are a school of rural public health, and so we focus primarily focus on rural areas. So for this particular project, we did only focus on rural areas.
That was actually one of the limitations. We have talked to some emergency management people that are in the private hospital sector, and they say that they think that public hospitals actually may have more emergency preparedness coordinators, and that may be because of the level of trauma centers, but there's nothing concrete that we have yet. The other problem is that private hospitals don't tend to want to share their data with us.
Yes.
I live in Seattle. We have a emergency preparedness activity for local neighborhoods where neighborhoods are encouraged to form committees, train people around search and rescue and turning off our gas meters and that sort of thing. In the case, we're mostly preparing for an earthquake. But we had an excellent leader for this activity who unfortunately left the project, and when she left, a lot of energy and enthusiasm and expertise went with her. Since then, they've tried to build on the Black Watch structure, which in general I think is a really terrific idea to build this sort of preparedness for indeterminate future events on existing underlying structures that deal with more daily events. But I think in our experience, Black Watch is owned by police departments who have really no experience doing community organizing, which is what Black Watch is. And I'm wondering if any of you have seen these underlying community structures be organized by entities in city government that are more equipped to do community organizing.
Right. Let me give it first to Chris, because I actually want to hear what she says about using the MRCs for that kind of mechanism, and then I'll let some of the other panelists pitch in.
The duties that you just described would be more applicable to what's called a CERT team, Community Emergency Response Team, and that also is part of the U.S. Freedom Corps, as is the Medical Reserve Corps. But you are correct. The mission of a CERT team is to assist first responders like police, fire, and EMS with community-level response. What they are beginning to do across the country is recognizing the two different missions of these groups and having them train together so that you could use crossover. And it points out to the issue that even police have very little experience with recruitment and retention of volunteers into agencies such as these. So with better marketing and better recognition by leadership that these two teams, these two types of volunteers together can create a very, very excellent synergy. So like in Hawaii, CERT teams are used when the surf is high on the North Shore and people shouldn't go swimming, especially tourists. CERT team members are brought out to actually rope off the beaches and sit there rather than pay a paid officer. They have a cell phone, and if someone goes in, they'll call the lifeguards or ocean safety or the police. But there is no reason why during a point of distribution exercise for influenza, CERT teams come and work in the pods right next to the MRC members. MRC will do the vaccinations, control the pharmaceutical inventory, and the CERT teams can be flow controllers, get wheelchairs for people that need access and such.
By the way, there are voluntary organizations in many communities like the American Red Cross that have community outreach components to them. I know in Seattle they have a very strong one, for example. And it fits with their core mission anyway. They have the capacity to manage volunteers and deal with some of the retention and recruitment issues that are going to be really incumbent upon this so that you're not dependent upon a single charismatic leader. They have an institutional mission to really address some of these things. There may be similar kind of voluntary organizations elsewhere.
Yeah, two things I think about that. One, based on the interviews that we did, one is I think there's a huge gap between the kind of neighborhood organizing that you're talking about, Amy, and all of the officials that we talked to. I think this question of how do we help community members be prepared for the unknown is a big conundrum. I would look to the official agencies as a source for that organizing. So I think that's one of the benefits of the kind of experience that we've had in Seattle. The other thing, which is not directly related to your question, but it reminded me that one of the interesting things we found is the role of shortwave radio operators in emergency preparedness, and the fact that many communities and hospitals have developed relationships with shortwave radio operators as their secondary communication system. And I know we use that in the what was that system called for earthquake?
Star
or something? Yeah, something like that. And so that was interesting to me, just to know that this technology is still out there. And in fact, you can organize them as a backup communication system.
Ham radio is not shortwave, it's VHF.
Okay, so ham radio? Yeah. Yes, question over there.
Thank you.
Yes, you.
Sure, I'm sorry. I was going so fast, so I would not go over time. I will give you my email address, and I'll be more than glad to send you the tool. And I very much encourage people to take the tool, adapt it, use it as is, I don't care, and try it out on the mainland or with other groups, and let's see if we get similar responses. So it's, I was going to give them my email.
Go right ahead.
Yeah? KQURESHI. You know what? I'll give you my business card. Yeah, I have business cards, but it's K Qureshi, KQURESHI, at hawaii.edu.
My comment is, and questions for Dr. Qureshi. I really enjoyed your presentation. And for collaboration purposes, you may be interested in knowing that your findings, as far as vocational breakdown and gender breakdown of interest in development reserve, were very closely mirrored with my own anecdotal experience in New York and Long Island advertising Army Reserve medical opportunities. Mm. So,
yes. Are you talking about something that would be akin to like the Army Reserves or
yes,
something
yes,
like that?
Yes.
Yeah. One, I think you'd get a different group of people because one of the big things that we have found in the MRC is people, when you sign up for something that starts giving you those kinds of benefits and it's a professional reserve corps, a sense of obligation comes along with that. You can't tell the government if they're giving you tuition benefits and other things, sorry, I can't come because work isn't going to release me. It's almost like the Army Reserves. If you get called up, you have to go. And I think that that would serve as a barrier for a certain segment, especially when you're talking about healthcare providers. No physician or dentist in private practice that I know could afford to be called up for 2 weeks and deployed someplace. It would kill their business. They need that to pay their rent and pay their personnel. You might attract a younger group of individuals who might be willing to take that risk or don't have the personal or the family obligations. So on one hand, I think it would impede it, but you would get the younger crowd who would sign up because those benefits would be lucrative to them. So I think it would be a double-edged sword from that perspective. The biggest thing that people said when we had exploratory meetings in Hawaii, just to see if there was interest in the MRC, and people would stand up and say, I'm not making this up. Are you sending me to Iraq or overseas? Or are you sending me to another state? Where we had to say no. So they were thinking like of the DMAT or something. Maybe you'd be deployed to California. And we said, no, this is local. And if you're available during the time, you come. If you're not, there is no obligation for you to respond. What you're proposing, there's a very strong obligation. So it would look different than it is. But that's why we think targeting and marketing retired healthcare workers might be a really good, and retired non-healthcare workers would be great. They're hardy, they have a lot to contribute, they have skills and experience, they have patience, they know how to work with people. So that's an untapped market that I think we need to explore. But that's just my opinion.
Okay, unfortunately we've run out of time. So I want to thank everybody for coming. Thank the panel again. I'm sure they'll stay here for a few moments so that if those remaining questions, please come up and ask them directly. So thank you very much. Nice job. Well done. Thank you. Good job to all of you.
Thank you.
I have questions for all of you.
Okay. I was going to address them just
about. Anybody who would like my card to email,
I was presenting yesterday about that we did this oral history in Louisiana, Mississippi.
I wanted to say something to your question. A researcher out of Drexel University is actually looking at cultural competency and emergency preparedness, but then this whole community organizing thing has happened. It's out of Drexel, and they actually now have a research clearinghouse on community organizing and emergency preparedness, if you're interested. But that's something we just started getting involved with.
We had a person named Luann Johnson who was just this amazingly phenomenal neighborhood level organizer around here.
But even the hospitals, in other words, to the public, I was wondering, do the public health officials think that
on the updated standards? Sir, you're hearing my hospital.
No, I don't think in our work, I would say there's no discrepancy, but I think this point about are the hospitals prepared? I don't think you'll find any emergency room directly. Not that I've talked to, and I've talked with them a number of times.
Where our security is tied in with local security, which are deployed in other places when an emergency comes.
Right, and on the public hospital side, what we were hearing was the city was supporting the public hospitals more in terms of security, perimeter security, and that sort of other support, because the private hospitals have their own resources to take care of themselves, which may be logically sound, but then you have hospitals kitty-corner from each other. other, who patients
like Tulane and Charity.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Those patients are having a very different kind of experience, and the staff is having a different kind of experience in this one's public and one's private.
That's exactly. Yeah. I would love to talk more.
Thank you. I'll have my card off.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I'll look up your association, because I had not actually heard of it before, which is kind of scary. So I'm sure you're doing a lot of good work that we need to be aware of.
Well, we just published our big report on preparedness in public hospitals. So,
can I ask both of you a question at the same time? Because I think you both have an interesting perspective. Nice seeing you again, Chris. You did.
Yes, I did. I was saying, I've met you like several times.
Yeah, years ago.
It's good to see you. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Enjoy your presentation.
I was, based on this and a prior panel, I was thinking, is there a way to find a data set of staffing patterns in hospitals post-event, post-whatever the disaster is, so you can actually empirically test how many people show up at a hospital by type of person. So I was, you know, thinking, is there some conventional measure that every hospital might have, and it may be payroll, but maybe there's something else, that they would know after the disaster for a period of time, so many people showed up, so many docs, so many nurses, so many support staff, et cetera, whether it's within the public hospitals or through, you know, the JCAH and how you may ask them to measure. Do either one of you have any ideas for a common measure?
I know what we do. I think there might be two ways, and this would not affect maybe the exact time period that you're talking about. One, I think the AHA database, because they do collect it on FTEs, I believe. So you could look at the day, and it would be, it's a yearly survey.
They just say, how many people generally do you have that fit this?
Yeah.
I need it very time specific.
Exactly, and we don't collect that time specific data either, especially because since we are an advocacy organization as well, when our hospitals are going through a disaster, there's still so much chaos that even going in and getting that data collected, I mean, they can't even get their characteristics, their financial data to us.
Right. So, I guess I wanted to do the hospitals keep tabs of who, and maybe even for liability or payroll purposes, but who is in their facility delivering care and even present that day, right?
Absolutely.
They are keeping track.
Yeah.
But you'd have to go hospital by hospital to essentially get it, or system by system. Yeah, which is, again, a membership group that would just can be encouraging but wouldn't have the data themselves.
They might. It's probably possible that they don't. In any individual hospital, I would be surprised if they didn't have it. But who would be interested in following that up?
Right.
And you may also have, the other thing that I think would be very important to get at is not only, okay, this person didn't show up, but did this person show up because, you know, they're missing or you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like,
oh,
well,
that's,
want to know.
But at the very first level, you want to know who showed up at all.
Exactly.
And is it even close to what they thought it was going to be? You know, we only got 80% of the docs like we thought, but we only got 20% of the transportation workers or the utilities or whatever, the boiler room.
Environmental.
Whatever it may be.
I think you're looking for something that would be really interesting to have that I've never seen.
Good for me and bad for me.
Well,
it's a nice little spot.
It's
getting the hospitals to come up with a common measure that they agree, like the payroll and account, if they're willing to do it.
And just getting them to be willing to.
Yes. They have an interest in wanting to share that information.
Of course.
They have an interest in tracking it because it is a payroll issue, tax issue, having a certain number of licensed staff.
It's a planning issue. I mean, they need to know. You know, I mean, I could see going back to them individually and saying, by the way, here's what they would know this. You know, here's what it looks like and how you compare to similar hospitals. That's what they would like to know.
But you would get the data also. I think maybe an easier system would be the University Health Consortium, which is all the academic
medical centers.
Because they're going to be tracking that a little bit more because of the graduate medical education and all that. So I think that they might actually have a better feel on that.
It's an idea. It's a good idea.
I know, now makes you want to go back to my hospital.
Well, only because, you know, we do all this stuff on ability and willingness to work. Uh-huh. You know, and it's all sort of perceived ability, willingness, what people say they'll do, but you'd rather look at the real behavior of what they've done. And there are enough emergencies, hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, floods, lizards, where hospitals are surging, and you have a way to empirically test. Well, how many people showed up?
Another source might be the professional associations, like the nurse associations in the state. So, like, they actually might have an interest in knowing that more nurses, knowing what their capacity is in the
trade.
But it's going to be kind of a hunt. It's going to be an Easter egg.
Bringing in an army.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the panel.
Thank you.
Good job.
I like, you know.